Welcome to the Everyday Board Game Podcast with Daniel.
And Daniel.
And today we're going to be doing another one of our board game breakdowns. And we decided to focus this week on
Thunderwork Games and the designer Keith Mateka.
So we actually reached out to Keith. He is running a Kickstarter right now and he is kind enough to join us today. Keith is joining us as our special guest and he'll be going over his games with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Anytime. Keith, this was exciting for me and Daniel, of course, because Daniel's a huge backer of your games. And I was skeptical at first. I'm not gonna lie to you. I was skeptical at first, and then he showed me Role Player. And I was like, oh man, this game is so smart. It's so good.
It hurts my brains in good ways.
Right. And so at first it was a good skeptical, and then I'm now won over on it. So I'm curious to hear about all the past projects that you've done, and sure. Tell us any stories that you'd like to about them. We'll go roughly in chronological order, as we tend to do. As always with our board game breakdowns, we don't tend to focus on expansions too much, but mainly the base games or sequels and whatnot. And if for some reason we pull up anything that you want us to skip, just tell us to skip it, and we're good to go. But sure. We're excited to hear about the future stuff as well.
Cool.
And so, before we get started, just to let everybody know who's in our audience and our audio podcast listeners later on, Role Player Ventures is live on Kickstarter. Go ahead and go check that out and look into it. It looks amazing.
Awesome. So, cool. Keith, we're going to start off strong right at the beginning. We're going to start off with Thunderworks. So, what made you create Thunderworks?
So, I mean, Thunderworks came about as a result of basically... I designed some board games and I wanted to publish them. Like, I saw guys like Jamie Stegmeier and some James Matthey and those other guys that are doing Kickstarter. And I basically, they were being really forthcoming about like their processes and like the problems that we're having and all like the planning that they were doing, and which was awesome. And I basically thought to myself, oh, that doesn't look so hard. I bet I could do that. So I basically created this small company that I was going to use as kind of like, a starting point, right? So like anytime you start deciding that you're going to start going down this road, then I was like, okay, now I need to have like my own separate bank account only for my business stuff versus my personal stuff. And like this entity needs a name. And I went through, I spent probably like 6 to 9 months like trying to find a cool name for the company. Uh-huh. Basically one day we were at, on the 4th of July, we were at a fireworks display, and my son, who must have been, 3 or 4, he saw like fireworks for the first time and he called them Thunderworks. And I was like, oh, that's actually a cool name. And the fact that like my little boy, help me name my company, I'm like, let's just go with that. So that's where the name came from. Yeah. And I had been designing a couple things in the background, and I had this really big like mech combat game that I was working on. Uh-huh. And then I saw these people being successful on Kickstarter, and I'm starting to like figure out manufacturing prices and all this stuff to figure out like how we could do that title. It basically boiled down to like the risk of a title that big, of it all falling apart, like is dangerous.
Yeah.
So I basically, I was kind of in the middle of doing all the graphic design for it. Ian O'Toole was working on it, who's now, he's a pretty well-known name in the industry. Yeah. And we were working on it for a while, and it just like wasn't working out very well, and we were having communication problems. And we basically both kind of walked away from that that arrangement. And so I was kind of at a decision point, like, do I kind of jump back into my mech combat game, or do I maybe try to do something smaller? Because I was like, just the idea of putting that kind of money up front and like hoping for a Kickstarter that's that successful for my first one to kind of cover the costs of it were kind of daunting. So I basically took a step back and I said, I want to make something small, you know? So yeah, the goal was like deck of cards with some bits. And I had just played Reiner Knizia's Battle Line again, which I love that game, and I hadn't played it in a long time, and I played it, I was like, man, this game is so good, like, it's so simple, like, you know, draw a card, play a card.
Yeah.
I was like, well, what would, if I were going to make a play a card, draw a card game, what would it be? And that's kind of where Bullfrogs came from, which was the first game that I published under the Thunderworks name, so that was my approach to that game was basically like, I want it to be play a card, draw a card. I want it mm-hmm. to be, you know, take more players than like Battleline or Lost Cities does. So like I originally was a 2 to 4 player design.
Okay.
And then through playtesting, there's like some stuff that came out of it. Like the way combat is resolved is very much inspired by in pandemic when the different diseases kind of overloaded town. So that's of the influence there. So thank you, Matt Leacock, for that. But so that was the first game I worked on. So that I ran a Kickstarter for it and had a mild level, you know, some nice success. I thought it was I was doing great with my first project, and I learned a ton on that project for sure. And one of the interesting things that came out of that, which leads into a lot of the single player design that I did, was that halfway, you know, I just had kind of an inspiration of like, hey. What would a single-player version of this game look like? Because I think backers might have been asking for something.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And people were kind of, they wanted to support me. I mean, there was a lot of family and friends that jump onto your first Kickstarter. And they were like, they wanted to give me more money, but they didn't have anything to, you know, to buy. I wasn't offering anything else to sell them. So I designed the solitaire variant for it that I thought was really fun. And I added that as an add-on. And like, it was crazy. I want to say like 60 to 70% of the people that backed the project all like paid an extra $8 or something like that for the solitaire variant. So I was like, it was kind of an eye-opening moment where like, oh,
sure.
People like solitaire games. I didn't realize that was such a big deal. I mean, this was like 2015 or something.
Right.
So like solitaire games have become huge since then. But like that was kind of like my first, like my pulse to like the solo game playing community, like, oh, this could be a big thing. So anyway, so the Bullfrogs was a fun project. It was the only that one was very much mechanics first and then like figure out the theme later kind of game.
Okay.
So like at the beginning it was just cards with cubes moving things around. And then I had like a big spreadsheet of possible themes and like how everything would potentially match up. And then eventually I landed on which was a suggestion from my wife, I think, the Bullfrogs theme. And then once the theme is kind of figured out, then I go back and I change things to make things more thematic, or like it kind of will spark new ideas of like, oh, what if it, you know, if you've got a lake with frogs on lily pads, there's got to be other stuff in the lake. So now we have this log card.
The log.
That's kind of the central piece of the game. So yeah, that game was very much mechanics first, which is, I think all the other games that I've done have not been that way. So it's kind of an outlier.
That's awesome. Yeah, we're going to get into the later ones after, and I would love to see like how, where you, that's one of the things I always ask the designers is where do you start, theme or mechanisms first, and that you answered it before I even had to ask. That's awesome. So, I mean, I used to own Bullfrogs. I actually got it in one of the monthly board game subscription boxes from back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so I used to own it, and a friend of ours used to own it as well, Trevor.
Oh.
They used to own it as well, and I remember we would show it off at the shop, and it was pretty well received. I liked the idea of just, it was really just a play a card, and then that gives you the number of actions. And if I'm not mistaken, every player has their own deck, and they have like basically the same deck, right? I mean, more or less, like
right.
They have the same number of actions. So there's no
everybody's decks are identical. The artwork is a little bit different.
Yeah.
But yeah, for the Kickstarter, the thing I learned about that project was in the world of Kickstarter is that like I was trying to minimize the cost for the whole product, so I could minimize my risk. And then as a result, I figured out that I kind of pulled out a lot of the things that were most interesting for people.
Oh,
so like
okay.
originally they were just cubes and cylinders instead of like frog shaped meeples and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I'd done that to kind of minimize the cost so that like, if I just hit this number, then I can still make the game and it's not gonna be as awesome as it could be, but At least I get to make it. But as a result of pulling those out, like, I pulled out the most marketable things about the game. It was like hard to get people excited about it when it was just like cubes and cylinders and stuff. So, like, I made a really, I don't know how quick it was. I should go look. But like, I made an adjustment real early on to just like quick unlock these frog meeples so that like people could like have something to talk about this game to get excited about. Besides, like, because you can't, as much fun as the game is or whatever, it's hard to sell gameplay, you know, over the internet, you know.
Right.
So after something that's cool to look at and interesting. So definitely, like, when people ask me for advice or they're talking about their Kickstarter projects, I'm like, you know, you won't need to. What is your bare minimum product, but make sure that you are not cutting out the cool part. Like, you've got to have something that, like, can be interesting to people, even at its kind of most minimal, like, you know, version of the game.
That's cool. So then, we're definitely going to be, so that's going to be a talking point for all of your future Kickstarter ones that we talk about. What is that key thing that you try to put into it? That's
right,
awesome.
Right.
All
right.
So you brought up solo modes. I'm going to jump into those real quick. So you created a solo mode for Bullfrogs, and then under Board Game Geek, there is a slew of titles, Herbaceous Sunset Sprouts. Over the Water, Herbaceous Sprouts, and the Whatnot Cabinet, that you've made the solo designs for those.
Right. So those are all coming out of my relationship with Eduardo Baraf. So Ed runs Pencil First Games, and obviously all those games were published by him. And our recollections of how this all went down between Ed and I are different for whatever reason. But Ed was a guy that I looked up to because he had published more games than I had, and he was like, I was an upcoming Kickstarter guy, and he was established. So and he's a super smart guy, and I used to ask him lots of questions, you know, just randomly, because that's what I do. You know, it's like, if I don't know how to do something, I'm just going to ask somebody who's done it before, even if I know them or not. And hopefully, you know, because if other people do that for me, then I'm going to try to be helpful as well. So the kind of the community of designers, especially I think during that period, was very a lot of camaraderie. And so I basically was talking to Ed, and then he had been working on this game Herbaceous that was designed by Stephen Finn. And out of the blue, I think he asked me if I wanted to work on the solo version of it. I happened to have a bunch of free time. There was a moment in time in which my mom was in the hospital, so I was spending a lot of time with the hospital. So I basically just like I would work on the game, and then I would just play it and work on it while I was kind of just hanging out at the hospital with my mom, and she's doing great now. But
that's good
to hear.
Yeah.
So I basically worked on that. I turned it around in just a handful of days, and he really liked it, and it kind of started this relationship of working together. And then that line of games, every one is just kind of bringing the band back together. So it's like Beth Sobel's on all of them. Steve is doing the design on all of them. I'm doing the solo design on all of them. So it's like I'm kind of in it, you know. Once I got in the door, then I'm kind of like doing all these solo designs for him. And it's really interesting because like Steve gets the game like pretty much done, and then it's like he hands it off to me, and I've never played it before, and it's like actually I interact mainly with Ed. I rarely talk to Steve, and he's like, here's the game, you know, come up with a solo version. So it's kind of like a little fun puzzle that I get to kind of just figure out and do what I can. And I always kind of negotiate with Ed about like, hey, I want to add a couple more cards, is that cool? Or I want to add these tokens, is that cool? And he's always pretty amicable about that stuff. So the solo modes have done well for those games, and I think people enjoy them. So I don't know, they're cool. They all have like a little. My philosophy about single player stuff is always like try to emulate the multiplayer experience as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So you kind of figure out the points of interaction with the other players and figure out like how you're going to simulate those with some kind of AI or some other mechanic, or they just get removed, and then as a replacement, like add in some kind of bell or whistle to make the single player experience feel interesting and unique. So it still needs to be rooted in the multiplayer experience, but it's got to have like some other little cool thing that's unique for the single player too. So
that's right.
That's what we're gonna.
So do you find yourself being a solo player yourself, or do you just like making that little puzzle for other players who tend to do it at home?
It's I I don't play a ton of solo stuff. The solo gaming I do play is mainly things that are narrative related. Like, I like things that tell a story.
Okay.
Something like Arkham Horror, the card game, or even the original Arkham Horror that I used to, the second edition of it that I used to play a lot of. I guess that, no, that's third, the third edition, I guess. But the big one, the Fantasy Flight did, that now is replaced with the one with the weird octagon things, or hexagon.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. So I tend to play solo stuff when it's narrative driven. So I play like a lot of game books, you know, choose your own adventure style with like, but with character tracking and stuff like that. But I don't play, I don't sit down and play Mage Knight very often, or I don't know. What else to play solo that's really good? I mean, like something like Ghost Stories or something like that, I probably would never play solo just because. I mean, my favorite thing about playing board games is sitting down with friends, and that's kind of where I am. I think I like the process of developing something for single player, but I tend to not spend my time playing those kind of games.
So okay. you probably spend more time developing it than playing it, huh?
I develop them and play them, and the best way to become a good designer, in my opinion, is just play lots of games. So it's kind of contradictory to like that philosophy of like, if you want to design good solo games, you should play a lot of solo games. I feel like that's probably true. I have not always followed that kind of methodology probably as much as I should have, but that's kind of, I prefer multiplayer games, but I do play some solo stuff, especially if it's something for one of my games, and obviously I played a bunch, but just kind of for funsies stuff, not as much.
That's fair. All right, Daniel, why don't you take this next one?
Okay, so this one is probably one of my favorite games of all time. This is the big boy role player right now is the next one on the line.
Yeah.
How did you come up with the concept of the theme where you're just making an RPG character, but you're playing with these dice to do it?
Yeah, so there's this series of conventions in the U.S. Called Protospiel. So they're like basically designer workshops. People sit down and play each other's games and rip them apart and give each other feedback. And I was sitting there with a friend of mine, James Ryan, who is actually the lead writer for Role Player Adventures. But he was showing me the game he was working on, which was somebody was running a contest for like an 18-card RPG.
Oh, yeah.
And he was like showing me that, and we played it a little bit. And one of the things that he had was like there were like these cards that had everybody got dealt two different cards, and one had like a positive thing, like a positive trait on both sides, and negative traits on the other two sides, and you picked which combination you wanted, and that was your character. Like, that was the character creation process. And I remember saying to him, like, you know, the game's okay, but I'd like this, you know, character creation process. And then it kind of just light bulb appears over my head. It's like, what if there was a whole game about making characters? And it's like, well, if you're going to have a whole game about making characters, they have to have stats. And if you have to have stats, you have to have three dice worth of stats. And if you have to have that, then you have to have a race in the class and weapons and armor and all this other stuff. So, like, obviously, I have a lot of experience playing both fantasy tabletop role-playing games like D&D and Pathfinder and stuff like that. But also playing a lot of video games. So like, I played a lot of like the Ultima games when I was younger on my IBM 46 and Icewind Dale and Baldur's Gate and all these old PC games, because I was a PC gamer for many, many years and worked in the video game industry for a long time too. But so I basically like took all those things, kind of exploded into my mind, and then I just started building. You know, it's like, okay, that character. I had this analogy in my mind, which was like, and this works for me, but it doesn't work for everybody. That like, to me, like role player is to like D&D or Pathfinder as like Dominion is to Magic the Gathering. So it's like,
okay,
it's the game before the game.
Yeah.
So that's, and I was like, okay, I want to focus on that and just have that be the thing. And even through development and even more so after the release of the game, there's like that certain percentage of people that say, this is a great game, I made this cool character, but now I want to do something with that character, right? So that's like, that's what I get, which is fine. that wasn't the focus of the project, but I understand that's what people want.
Right.
So that's kind of where the Monsters and Minions and Fiends and Familiars expansions comes from, of like, kind of a partial answer to that question. We're like, hey, here's some combat, here's some additional pieces you can manage. But they never were like the real full answer of like what I know people want of like, I want to take this character on an adventure. So, which is kind of where Roleplay Adventures came from. Like, and that's this project has been in, I've been working on it for like over 3 years with James. It's been a long project. I'm super excited to see like kind of hitting the light at the end of the tunnel in terms of like actually having it done enough to show people and bring it to market. But and anyway, dialing back to roleplay a little bit. I'm sorry.
It's all good.
Back a little bit, like, yeah. So roleplay, I had that idea, and then I just start prototyping as fast as you can. I mean, that's the best way to do development. It's like, you have an idea, get it out of your head as fast as you can. Mm-hmm. And that just means there's a character sheet and there's slots for dice. And it's like, so I'm at the store buying like prototype dice and all that stuff. And there's a lot of stuff from that initial idea that still made it into the final game. You know, there's the idea that there's three slots per character, per stat, that there's like, you're trying to hit certain statistics. The fact that everybody has a class card that has goals on it. Those are all like, from the very first draft, those were all there. The things that changed the most probably over the course of the game was the alignment system was one of the later adds. The final version, there's like a 3x3 grid that has the cube that moves around this between different alignment statuses. And basically when you buy traits that can move it, and then if you use skills, it has to move it. So that was originally like a binary scale that went like from, you know, it was like a 5-point scale that went up and down instead of like going left and right as well. So that changed significantly. And then it was interesting, how the price of the game dictated the complexity of the game on this one.
Really?
Which, so basically I knew I needed 73 dice if I wanted to support 18 slots on 4 players' boards, because you always need one extra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it needed 73 dice, and 73 dice, when it comes to manufacturing, is a significant number. So it's like, Okay, it needs this amount of dice, I need this amount of cardboard, and I'm going to these manufacturers, and they're saying, hey, this is going to cost. I mean, when it comes to, people talk about this 1-to-5 ratio of manufacturing cost to MSRP to like make everybody's cuts work. And it's usually a 1-to-5 landed cost, which means it's the cost to manufacture the game plus the cost shipping. To ship it to at least your distribution warehouse. Yeah. And because of all the dice and the size of the dice bag, it was going to be, you know, it needed to be like a $60 game.
Right.
And the way it was set up, the gameplay didn't feel like heavy enough to be like a $60 game.
Right.
So I basically added complexity to the game so that people would have this feeling that it was worth the price of admission. So the idea that the initiative cards are all out, and that you get to pick which one you want, and that's going to determine your purchase order in the next phase, that was like a late add. That was something that like that was added as a result to kind of make that choice beefier in that phase of the game. Initially, it was just like, roll out random dice, and then everybody picks one and puts it where they want, and then they get to do an action, which was fine, but the decision point was simpler. And actually, Sagrada does something similar to that. So actually, I'm glad I didn't do that to differentiate those games a little bit even more.
Right.
So that was kind of an interesting bit. The solo game actually came on really late, too. I wasn't planning on doing a solo game. I guess I wasn't 100% convinced that, like, that solo games were a thing, but you know, there was enough people that were asking for it, so I was in the middle of the Kickstarter campaign. I just like cleared the desk, get the game out, let's figure this out. And, like, literally within like 45 minutes, I'm like, okay, this is what it is. I played it a couple times, and it's like, seems pretty good, and then just ship it. And like, literally, it's very highly regarded. I mean, people love it, and people play it all the time. And I mean, I guess it speaks to the fact that the core game was in a really solid spot.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, kind of coming up with the solo part was not that big a deal. But I'd blinded myself in thinking, like, this game can't have solo. And I put up these little blinders, and then enough people kind of, like, punched me in the arm to like actually try it. I was like, oh yeah, this is pretty simple. So the solo game came together really quick, and kind of it was a bit of an afterthought, but it's people have been enjoying it like crazy. So
yeah, cool. I enjoy the solo play version of this. It's just fun for me to bust out and play it and get through when nobody's here, especially during the pandemic issue.
100%.
Yeah, and you brought up an interesting fact on this. Like I've felt this in my own games. Like I've made like big, like more grandiose, like Euro style games, and they've gone over well. But then like it seems weird that like the game I came up with in an hour, that's like a small little pusher like card game, is like my more popular one. You
that's
know,
the one people want to play. Yeah,
yeah, that's the one that people want to play. It's a bizarre idea in a designer standpoint.
People ask like, how long did it take you to work on that thing? It's like, it doesn't matter. Like either, like you can slave over something for years and it'd be mediocre, or you can like come up with an idea in a half hour and it could be amazing. Like,
right.
It just doesn't work that way, you know?
Yeah. The amount of time doesn't matter. It's the end product. Right.
And what's interesting to me is that Roleplayer not only helped put Thunderworks big time on the map, it also started a whole world. So you have, we'll talk about them a little bit later, but there's other games that you publish that are in the same world and lore as Roleplayer.
Yeah. I can. You want me to talk about that? I can talk about that.
Yeah. You know what? Let's jump into those right now, and then we'll backtrack into the kind of off end games. So
yeah. So I mean, basically, it comes from the idea of like, I like fantasy games. People pitch me fantasy games. I come up with fantasy games, and it's like, well, if I'm gonna do a game, like, why don't I just have them connected? You know, that's purely the thought process. Like, why should I make all these separate little fantasy worlds? Well, they could just be one, and that's cool. And I mean, Fantasy Flight was doing that with their Terranoth stuff, where like Descent and all their stuff was kind of in the same world. Although, very loosely, the characters had the same name, but that's like the lore was pretty loose.
Yeah, why are they trading goods in the Mediterranean? I don't know, but not that they did, but.
So yeah, I've been trying to build up this world. I saw James Matthey trying to do this with his Manhattan Project games, which I don't think was a particularly like great success in connecting them. But I think it boils down to like that can't be the main thing, right? It can't be like, hey, it's a game in the world of Roleplayer, then like expect people to care. Like it has to be a great game, and then if it happens to be in this world, then great. It kind of rooted from, we were working on Roleplayer Adventures in the background for so long. And when Stan Kronowski showed me Lockup, he was calling it Fantasy Lockup at the time. And I was like, well, this is cool. And then, obviously I signed that game, and it's like, well, how do we integrate this into like the world of Roleplayer Adventures? And then it's like, well, we'll just make an entire campaign module taking place in this exact same place. because the world for Roleplayer Adventures was so open, there was like very little we had established, because the initial idea was that Roleplayer was supposed to be kind of as generic as it can get, so that like people can put their own characters into the characters that they're building. Sure. Now we went from super generic to like, now we're going hyper specific, and there's all this space to fill. So it's just like, all right, well, let's just throw in this Lockup World stuff, and let's throw in this other stuff. Like, we don't have the answers to these, and here are answers that are readily available. We'll just slot them in. and that's the way it's worked out. And it's been fun to make all these kind of connections and forward-thinking Easter eggs and stuff. So there's like, you know, for example, there's a handful of things that are on the Lockup board that you're going to find in Roleplayer Adventures. And there's like, in Cartographers, there's So like in Lockup, if you look in the smithy, there's a hammer that's leaning against the wall in there. That's an item that you get in Roleplayer Adventures.
Oh, that's cool.
And, like,
really?
If you look in the cell block underneath one of the chairs, or underneath one of the beds, there's a tiny little like silver, like a gray triangle, which is like part of the chisel that you get in Roleplayer Adventures when you're in there and stuff like that. So we've just been having fun with it, you know?
Yeah.
And there's like in Cartographers, one of the cards has a banner for a tavern called the Golden Axe, which is a weapon within Roleplayer Adventures. And there's like all kinds of these little kind of connections that we've had to make because it's like, you need to come up with stuff. Well, we've got this other stuff that's already made up. Well, why don't we just like pull connections from this stuff instead of like just coming up with brand new generic stuff? So it's been really super fun to kind of build out this world. And
yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see where it goes. I mean, my philosophy has been, like, I want every game in the Role Player Adventures universe to be kind of different mechanically. I mean, we have a new version of Cartographers coming, which is probably an exception of that. But, like I don't want to do another Roll and Write game in the Role Player Adventures world. I want to do, like, an area control, or I want to do some kind of, you know, action selection game or something like that.
Yeah, right.
So, and I'm just trying to make sure that, like, all those games are super high quality and people like them, so.
Oh, they're amazing games. I really enjoy Lockup. It's probably one of my favorite worker placement styles, especially because there's some hidden information in there, and I like the fact that you can put them face down. What am I playing face down? And so you're trying to math what other people are doing.
Yeah.
See, there's kind of like bluffing element there, which is fun, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, what I appreciate from what Thunderworks is doing, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like you're basically taking, like, you know, Ameritrash, your fantasy, like these really, like, depthful themes and combining it with, like, I'm a Euro gamer. I don't care about theme at all. Like, everyone who listens to our podcast knows this. I could care less about theme, but I appreciate the mechanisms. Like, Role Player sold me, like, as soon as I found it, as soon as you made me show it, I was hesitant because I just don't care about RPG stuff, right? And then he made me play it, and I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. Like, this hits me in such a good Euro-y style.
I mean, it comes from my personal taste in games, you know? It's like, I'm driving all this stuff. I like Euro games, but I also like, you know, an interesting theme, and, like, and as a result, my games tend to have, like, Euro hearts with, like, thematic exteriors. That's, like, the best of both worlds, and so far, it seems like people have, you know, kind of their tastes are aligning with my tastes, and it's all kind of working out. So
yeah,
I'm just gonna kind of keep doing what I'm doing, you know.
Yeah, it's bridging that awesome gap. So we're looking at Lockup on the page here. I love the Easter egg. Last week we did an episode where we talked about board game Easter eggs. So that's a beautiful tie-in. That worked out perfectly.
Cool.
So when you were approached with the design for Lockup, did you know that you were going to put it in the Role Player universe at first?
No. I was, like, the thought hadn't occurred to me. I think it might have been Stan's idea, the designer. It might have been his idea. Like, hey, man, you should put this in the Role Player universe. And I get that comment all the time, like, hey, I got this game I want to show you. It could work in the Role Player universe. Like, I get sick of that comment. But I am looking for those things from time to time. But just because it could work in the Role Player universe doesn't mean, like, it's something that I should be doing. But I hadn't really been thinking about it. And there was, I think it might have been Stan's original idea. But I just played it because I thought it was cool. Like, it was, and when I first played it, it reminded me, like, this is, like, maybe a little bit more, like, a different take on an entry-level worker placement game. Like, I always associate, like, Stone Age being, like, the entry-level worker placement game for me.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, this had a lot of the same things that Stone Age does, but has this kind of really interesting, unique theme, where it's, like, you know, you kind of know who's winning, but a lot of points you can get at the very end. It's got, like, this, like, there's only a handful of places you can put your people. Mm-hmm. But instead of rolling dice in Stone Age, now we're kind of measuring strength by flipping over some hidden information. So, I thought it would be a great... I thought there was a lot of space in that entry-level worker placement area.
Yeah.
Because I think Stone Age is kind of the one people always mention. It's like, well,
sure,
I want people to mention Lockup instead. You know, basically my thought. It wasn't kind of role-player themed, but it was prison-themed. It was still fantasy prison-themed, which I thought was... You know, I think doing a prison game is maybe a little bit potentially, you know, problematic.
Yeah.
But, like, if you put the fantasy veneer over it, like, then it seems like people are okay with it. So.
And I like how in this game you're playing as the fiends, basically, from the fiends and, or not the fiends and familiars, but the monster and minions expansion. You're playing as the minions.
Right. You get to play as the bad guys. I always like that. Right. So, like. You know, there's the old RTS, like, where you get to build the dungeon for the monsters to come in.
Oh,
like,
Dungeon Keeper.
Yeah. Dungeon Keeper, you're right, or Dungeon Lords, the board game, or Dungeon Pets. So, like, I like those kind of games where it kind of flips the usual on its head. So, it's cool.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Well, let's go ahead and continue in the role player line then. Let's go to the next one, and that would be cartographers.
Yeah, so cartographers, like, this was another one where, like, somebody's like, hey, I've got a game for you. You should put it in the Role Player Universe. I was like, yeah, whatever. I'm like, really? So what happened is my graphic designer, Luis Francisco, he has done graphic design on all my games so far. And he had licensed this game for his. He also owns part of a publishing company in Brazil, and he licensed it in Brazil. I was like, hey, I've got this game. We're only going to publish it in Brazil. What do you are you interested in the rest of the world rights on it? I was like, I don't know. You know, I'm busy. I'm busy working on Roleplay Adventures. And he said, just read the rule book. And he sent me the rule book, and it was like so poorly translated, right? Because it was like Google Translate style translation. So I was like, dude, I'll just rewrite this rule book for you because this is awful. So then I like rewrote the rule book for him. You know, it's a short rule book, and Luis
Sure.
is a good friend of mine, so it's no big deal. And then I was like, well, now that I know how to play, I might as well try it. So I like sat down and played. I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. So I basically said, yeah, let's do it, because I was looking for a smaller project. Lockup was done, which was a bigger project. Roleplay Adventures is this massive project. I was like, it'd be kind of cool to do something small. And you know, there was a lot of people talking about roll and write games and flip and write games or whatever, but I thought it would be I'm not really one to like just kind of try to latch onto a trend. Like, I just want to do my own thing and not worry about anybody else. But I was like, well, I know people like this kind of stuff, so let's just do it. And then there was like, well, if we rush it, we can like push it forward and get it out for Essen, which would have been 2 years ago. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to take my time, get some awesome artwork from Lucas, who did all of Lockup, get him to do Cartographers as well. And like, when it comes out, but I want it to look amazing, yeah. So we did, that's what we did. And it was an experiment project, right? So like, this is the only project I've ever done that wasn't on Kickstarter. I tried using a new manufacturer for it. And it was like I'm going back to kind of smaller games because I've done larger games since then. And I took some pre-orders on my website and sent some copies out to reviewers because they asked for them. Like, I didn't really do a whole lot of marketing, and then it just like caught fire, man. You know, so like, came out of Gen Con, pre-sold a ton of copies, brought as many as I could get from China ahead of time, and sold through most of those. And it's been a great game for, especially with the pandemic. It's a great kind of distancing game. And it builds, like, I hadn't really thought about it. It's like, okay, I have the character builder, and now I like building maps. And when you play D&D, is a thing too. So now I've got the map builder. So like, the next joke is like, you know, are you going to come out with like a miniature building game or something like that? I don't have plans for that. But yeah, so Cartographers has been great, and the designer, Jordi Adan, he's Brazilian, and I met him through my graphic designer, and it's been a great relationship. So, and people, I mean, I just kicked off another printing of it. I mean, it continues to do well, and I've got more in the world coming. So,
And then I know, again, with the same thing with role player, he wasn't just like, eh, cartographers, it's an interesting concept, but I don't know how it's going to work in this fantasy world. And then I got him to play it, and he's like, I hate when you do this to me.
it was more interesting because at first glance I thought it was like, okay, it's just another flip and write, no big deal. And as always, I'm finding this is apparently a trend with your games. Now I feel bad telling the owner of the company.
I'm
No, but
converting him into a fan of
which is
Thunderworks game.
awesome. Yeah, and so
I need more Daniels.
right, exactly. I know he's helping you out. No, I'm really impressed with it, and of course, congratulations is in order. You're nominated for the Kenner Spiel.
Yeah, that's
That's
great. I
huge.
mean, it's interesting. It is huge. I mean, in all honesty, it's huge for Germany. It's cool for the U.S. But in terms of like, it depends on how you measure success, right? If you measure success in like sales of units, like the Kenner Spiel like doesn't sell many units in the U.S. Like, what I've been told is like having the Kenner Spiel logo on your box versus having like the Dice Tower Seal of Excellence, like the Dice Tower one is actually going to sell you more copies. But in Germany, it's huge, and My publisher of cartographers in Germany is Pegasus Spiel, and they do a great job, and they're definitely leveraging the nomination, and obviously we hope to win. We've got some pretty stiff competition. You know, I think it seems like people are saying that the crew is favored to win, but obviously I'm hoping Cartographers does. And I really want to play The King's Dilemma for whatever. It's out of print, and I wanted to get it when it was, and I missed it. So
yeah, same.
I really want to play that game.
Sure.
But anyway, Counter-Spiel, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, how many games, you know, get nominated for Counter-Spiel every year? Like three.
Yeah.
And mine, one I publish is one of them. That's crazy, you know. So
yeah,
I'm honored to be nominated, and I have my fingers crossed.
I'll come out
on top.
I'm hoping you guys do pull it off for the simple fact that it also would be nice for American games, because it would be 2 years in a row that an American-made game won the Kinderspiel, and it would...
Well, American produced.
Produced, yeah.
I mean, who won the Kenner last year?
Wingspan.
I thought they won the Spiel des Jahres. Oh, did they win the Kenner?
They won the Kenner.
Yeah, last year the Spiel was... it wasn't just one.
Was
it just one?
I think it was just one last year.
Okay, yeah. Yeah,
sure.
we had a whole podcast. We broke down every Spiel. Yeah,
I mean, it's cool. I talked to Jamie is one of my idols. So I talked to him about his experience with that too. So it's interesting. It'll be great.
Yeah, it is. We had him on the podcast a couple weeks ago, and it's great seeing like all the different publishers like locally. Like it's almost like a like. Like I wanted, the goal was to make it this big, of course, but I didn't expect it, you know, at the same time, you know, Jamie Segmeier said he sold like 500,000 copies of Wingspan or something like that. Like just some obscene number. It's like, it hasn't been out for like a year yet. Like that's like 1,000 a day. What's wrong with you? Why?
His print numbers are crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Do you mind me asking like what your print numbers look like, or like, because Cartographers it's been
the
a
thing
big
is,
hit.
I think Jamie prints all his other international, he prints all the languages.
Oh,
I only print English, and then I license it out to other publishers. So
very cool.
I want to say Cartographers is in 11 languages or something like that at this point.
Oh wow.
And obviously I get payment for that stuff too, but I don't take on any of the risk as well. So
right.
I don't control it as closely.
It's like the same idea that like I know 2F Spiel is printed by Stronghold here in America. It's the same.
Right.
Yeah, they take on like same idea.
Yeah, for sure. So like, Simon publishes Cartographers in Thailand. Ogre Game publishes it in Polish. Raven Games publishes it in Italian. You know, there's like 11 languages or something. But in terms of U.S. copies, the numbers aren't crazy, but I probably printed over 50,000 units of it, but those aren't like Jamie Stegmeier numbers.
For hobby gaming, Jamie Stegmeier's Wingspan is just an outlier. For hobby gaming, those are pretty steady.
Those are
numbers.
Fantastic numbers. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm used to hearing like 5 to 10 at most, like on average.
Yeah, I mean. Most people say like 5,000 copies of something is kind of like a success, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And role players done about the same amount of numbers. So I think by the end of the year, I'll have sold more copies of Cartographers than I will have of role player. And that's just for the sheer fact that the price point's low.
Yeah, the price point
is accessible.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think a big part of it too is I know I picked it up when the pandemic really started and lockdown was starting to go down. I picked it up then and been playing a lot. It's something that can be streamed. I've seen a lot of YouTubers and streamers just stream live play with their audience with it.
Oh yeah.
Yep. It works well.
Very cool.
So
now I want to rewind a little bit more as well now. So we're going to get back into the role player universe here in a bit when we talk about future projects.
Sure.
So let's jump back in time to 2016. Clearly going in brand. Let's talk about Blendoff.
So Blendoff is a small family speed dice rolling game about making smoothies that I published. So I found this game at a Protospiel from Scott Eaton from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I mean, it was I was looking for something. I didn't know what I was going to do next. I had Bullfrogs was done. I think kind of at the same time I was starting to work on Roleplayer, but like I started looking for what the next thing was going to be, and I found Blendoff, and I had this. I just think that game has a certain pure joy to it. Like when you play it, it's just like it's just crazy, rambunctious, and fun. And I could see what I played the prototype, and I can see the final product in my mind. Uh-huh. You know, this seems like a cool project. You know, nothing. It's not super extensive. Like, you know, let's just give this a go. And I was excited about it. And it struggled on Kickstarter the first time around, and then I took on more of the risk myself, and then succeeded the second time. And I did a small print run of it, and I still have, I think, 6 copies of it left or something. So I'm down to like the final copies of it, and it's you know, it was an experiment. I wouldn't say it was a grand success by any stretch of the imagination, but like I really liked the theme. Mm-hmm. And I liked the kind of the pure joy that it brought me when I played it. I did find that the lesson that I learned, one of the many lessons I learned on that project is like, it's when I sign a game, I have to acknowledge the fact that I'm going to be demoing this game for years,
right,
at conventions, at the stores. Is this game, you know, can I see myself doing that?
Yeah.
And when it came to Blendoff, like I struggled, like I was excited about it. It came out and I did some demoing of it and playing it, but like, it's not a game that has like really long legs by any stretch of the imagination. So like, I grew tired of demoing it. And I just wanted to focus my attention on role player stuff. So,
makes sense. Yeah.
I don't want to say like I abandoned it. Like I abandoned my child in a grocery store parking lot or something, but it was definitely a game that like I didn't think had as much potential as other things that I was working on, so right, it probably didn't get as much attention as some of my other titles.
Okay,
but I still think it's cool. I think the parts are beautiful, and I think the design is clean, and I think it's for families. It's a great option. It's totally a game that I can see like, if I have a cabin in the woods, I have a copy of Blendoff on the shelf because,
right,
like, you know, we're gonna just do some drinking and throw some dice and yell at each other.
Which is always fun.
I mean, it's a short game too. The other thing I learned about that title is that like, because in my mind there were these awesome wooden bits and the dice were full color and 4 sides and they were engraved and they looked amazing, and but it was another one of those price things. It's like, okay, to get that game at that quality, that means this has to be a $25 game. And I think when people say, oh, it's a 5-minute long game and it cost me $25, like I have a disconnect there, right?
Yeah, sure.
So it's like, well, maybe if I were to do it all over again, maybe I would kind of work to get the price down to 15 or something like that. And maybe cut some corners on the you know, maybe it doesn't need like linen cards and maybe it doesn't need like the highest quality everything, but it's hard for me to make that decision of like, well, this doesn't have to be amazing. It's like, no, I want all my games to be amazing.
Yeah.
But if it's $25, it's hard to sell it to anybody. So
right, exactly. Like the non-informed gamer who might pick this up might pick up Monopoly for cheaper, unfortunately.
Right,
you know.
And yeah, Monopoly, the box is huge, and this one, the box is this big,
right?
It's like, people, the box size can dictate price in people's mind like crazy. So like, no matter what's in the box, if it's this big, people won't pay more than $20 for it. It's like,
yeah,
okay, you know,
yeah.
Like if you're looking out for that dude that wants really easy to travel games, you know, that person is like, if you try to cater to those people, then you're gonna struggle, which is always kind of disheartening, I think, a little bit, but
yeah, in a weird way, because you almost wanted this to be like an impulse buy, like the kind of be like at the register, you know, it's like, oh well, yeah, I'll just pick that up, you know, but yeah, like, but people would look at that and go, oh well, it's like a $10 card game versus $25. No, and they judge it before they had to play it, which is a shame. Yeah,
I know a guy like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just how it works. I totally understand that part. Like, I made like a 15-minute dice game that uses 60 dice. So like 15 minutes is a lot. It's not very much, but 60 dice. that's a high price point. You know, you can't, it's hard to justify that. So, all right, let's continue.
Yeah.
We are going to go into a definite swing.
Let's take this dual one. Powers.
Dual powers, yeah, man. So it's funny, I signed dual powers and lockup at the same time. I was looking for, like, what is my next project? And dual powers was a game designed by a local buddy of mine, Brett Myers. I'm out of Madison, Wisconsin. There's, like, a ridiculous number of designers and publishers here. But, and, like, I played, he told me about it. I was like, oh, that sounds cool. And then Kane Klenko, I don't know if you know him. He's a, mm-hmm. he designed, like, Fuse and...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Dead Man Tell Tales and stuff. And he's from the area, too. And he's like, hey, Keith, you should look at this game. It's really good. I was like, okay, sure. So I looked at it, and I like it. I think it's cool. And I also was kind of having this problem in my mind of, like, I've been working on all these fantasy games. Like, I don't know. I mean, I like fantasy games, but I don't know if I want to be, like, Mr. Fantasy Game. Like, I don't know, want to be, like... Oh, that's, I mean, right now it kind of is that way of, like, hey, he's the role player guy.
Yeah.
So I'm like in that pigeonhole. But I want to be able to get out of that at some point. So, like, sure. I just want to publish games that I think are cool. And so Dual Powers is, you know, a historical game, two-player game, two-player, or one or two-player game, I should say. And that was one of the ones where, like, Brett came to me as a two-player game. I'm like, hey, I like this game, but, like, every single Thunderworks game has to have a one-player version, so go figure it out. and he enlisted some help on that, and they did a good job coming up with an interesting single-player mode for that game. I liked it because it was like a war game I could sit down and play over lunch hour, over 45 minutes. And people, that's been the hardest thing about that game, is communicating to people that, like, what they see and what they expect it to be isn't necessarily what it is. They see this, like, war game looking thing, and they assume, oh, this is going to be Hex Encounter. It's going to take me 3 hours to play. The rule book's going to be, like, you know, read like a tax document. I don't want anything to do with that. But it's not that game. And so it's been difficult kind of communicating to people, like, why it's cool, because it's 45 minutes. It's short. The rule book, it plays, it's a Euro game at the end of the day. Like, it has the same kind of Euro feelings that most of my games do. So it definitely feels like an outlier, and I think even, like, Tom Vassell said something about that when he did the initial review. It's like, this is a weird one for Thunderworks. It's like, it's interesting, like, how do people decide what's weird for me? It's like, I just, right. my determining factor is, like, do I think this game is good? And, like, you know, is this something that I want to work on? You know, so,
yeah.
Which maybe isn't the best criteria, but it's definitely what it has been so far.
Yeah, so for me, this one has actually been on my radar because it does something you don't really see a lot of, and that's a historical theme on it. And I really do like those kind of games.
It's cool that it's historical, but you can ignore all the history and still play the game, no problem, like any other Euro game. So it's just like... you know, I love Euro games, and I love Euro gamers, so no offense.
I was thinking the same thing, is because at first, like, it appears like it's like, oh, this looks like a heavier, like, something that GMT would make, you know, like at first, and then, but I adore two-player Euro games. Like, that's one of my favorite, that's my bread and butter, is I love it, just a two-player back-and-forth Euro game. And the fact that you're saying this now, I know a place that's selling it, so I might.
Well, yeah, I don't have many copies of it left, so grab it while you can, for sure.
Oh yeah.
And so I don't know if it'll ever come back. I don't know if there's a demand for it, but so that Dual Powers, Brett Myers, it's a great game. It's kind of an outlier. I'm doing more historical games in the future. There's another one coming up called Cape May, which is illustrated by Michael Menzel. For any Euro fan, knows that.
Oh yeah, yeah, we know. I know Michael Menzel. Sorry.
So that one's called Cape May. That's designed by a guy who lives on the east coast of the U.S. It's basically a city building game in Cape May, New Jersey, which is like one of the first kind of resort towns in the U.S. So around the 1900s. So that is kind of my next kind of historical game. So I want to do more of those.
That's cool.
Well, that's fine by me. As a former history major, that kind of stuff excites me.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, the fact that it's rooted in reality is, like, you know, there's only so many, like, goblins and and novels you can take, I think, in a lifetime. But I do like things that are based in reality sometimes. I mean, one of my favorite designers is Martin Wallace, and a lot of his early designs are very historical. Mm-hmm. Like, one of my favorite from him is Tinner's Trail, which is an economic game about mining in Cornwall. It's cool.
Yeah, nice. Very specific theme, but very, very awesome.
Just his Brass series, too.
Yeah.
Yes, Brass, it's behind me.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Dual Powers looks really cool. I'm genuinely excited for it. I'm going to go now on to Skulk Hollow.
Yeah, Skulk Hollow came out of my relationship with Ed Baraff over at Pencil First Games. Roleplayer hadn't blown up yet. It was like the Kickstarter was delivering. It had a kind of a okay Kickstarter. I printed a minimum number of copies. And they were kind of on the water, and Ed's like, hey, my kid came up with this idea. I've been working on it, but I would love some help. You want to take over the design of this project? And I was like, I was still working my 9-to-5 job. But the idea of like, hey, I can work on another game and don't have to do all this publishing work. Because like the publishing part of, you know, like game, it's like 90% to 10%. Like design is like 10% of the process and 90% of all the publishing work.
Yeah.
Whether it be marketing or, you know, working with manufacturers or whatever. I was like, I can work on another game and I don't have to do all that publishing shenanigans. So, he sent me the brief, like he had like a handful of bullet points that he wanted to see. And, I just designed it from the bottom up, and he wanted to see, like, you know, small guys versus big guys, asymmetric play. There's some stuff he wanted that I disregarded, but, in general, like, very kind of low luck. I mean, like, no dice. Like, he specifically said no dice in this game. Like, he wants it to be like card play. So and so I just designed it for Ed on the side, and then he kind of just ran with it. And so we've been working on, and it did well. I mean, I always get this question, like, hey, how come you didn't publish this? And since then, like, I quit my day job and I'm working on this full time, and I probably could have published it myself, but you know, I promised Ed I would work on it for him, so I did, and he's a friend. And then once Skulk Hollow was successful on Kickstarter, all these conversations were coming up, like, well, what are we doing next? You know, so Small Peak is the next version in the Skulk Hollow world, which I, you know, and Ed's like, do you want to work on this? I know you're busy. And I was like, I can't let somebody else touch my baby. So I started working on Malpique again, for Ed. And so those, and that has like four new monsters that you can fight with. I did the basic design of them and got them like maybe 80-90% of the way there. And then he's got a fantastic developer that's kind of helping finish them off. It's been really tough to do playtesting in the quarantine environment. So.
Right.
And I've been busy with a million other things. So I think probably, you know, if Ed wants to do more stuff in the world of Skulk Hollow, I'll probably bow out and say, you got this, buddy. I've got my own company to run. it's been a fun ride, and people have really been digging it. And I really like it quite a bit. I mean, it's an asymmetrical little foxes fighting this big monster that you get to climb up, and it's very kind of inspired by Shadows of the Colossus. And
I was about to say that sounds like it. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's very inspired by that, and there's a ton of variety in the game, and it's also another short one. It's another one that I think works well over lunch hour, you know, in the world in which like people went to offices and worked with each other for all day long.
Yeah, back in the day.
Where you can sit down and play it for 35-45 minutes and have a good time and have a full game and eat your, you know, bologna sandwich and get back to work, you know. So Skulk Hollow is a great game, and it's definitely Ed's most successful title, I think, to date, at least on Kickstarter. And then it does well for him, and we're going to do more. So that's Skulk Hollow.
That's awesome.
All I got to say, though, is the placeholder cover that they have on BGG from All Peak is going to creep out a lot of arachnophobes.
One of the big monsters is a big snake, big spider.
A big spider?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not nightmare fuel at all.
The artist that works on that series has a history of working on for Disney. So he did a bunch of Disney stuff.
Oh, really?
Oh.
So we had to actually push him relatively hard to be like, not make it so cute. Like, no, this is gonna be dark, man. You gotta go dark. And like, this is as dark as this guy goes. You know, this is like, his dark is like well above the average person's dark. But he did a great job. It's got a cool look. You know, I don't know of any other games that look like Skull Hollow, so that's cool.
That's really cool. Yeah, no, that I never heard of it.
I've heard of Skull Hollow. I've seen a lot of people. I try not to get too many two-player games because my wife is not as big as a board gamer anymore, so I need those grandiose games to play.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
It's kind of billed as like a, you know, a premium two-player experience, you know?
Yeah.
And it's got the best, arguably the best miniatures in the entire, or best meeples in the entire world. They're crazy. They're yeah. huge meeples, and they look really awesome.
We just had some pictures pulled up of them, and they look great.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like almost towering over the box itself. It's so good.
there's four big monsters, like the tentacle guy, and then there's the burrowing guy, and there's like the big bear guy with the club, and somebody else I can't remember. that's great.
That's really great. I just found a wonderful perspective image. I just want to show our audience, like where you're looking over the shoulder of one of the big dudes. I just want to show that real quick. Yeah. A good photographer too. All right, so yeah. we talked about the past, we talked about where you are now. Now let's jump into the future.
Go to theme park first. Let's talk. Right. Let's leave Role Player Adventure for the last one.
Okay.
Sure.
So what can you tell us about theme parks?
Theme parks is a game I'm working on. So this is designed by Nate Linhart out of Chicago. He showed this to me at Gen Con last year, and I just like the theme. Like, I love the amusement park theme, and it's a tetronomo game, right? So everybody's okay. each one of the tetronomos is a specific ride. So when we were talking about like what makes this game interesting and unique and like stand out against the crowd. This game has like a 3D carousel in the middle of the table that you turn.
Oh, wow.
And it's got like some worker, the way it gets turned determines pricing on the different rides that you can buy. It's a little bit of worker placement. You're putting your workers down in different areas. You've got your own board that represents kind of like where, you know, similar to Baron Park or something like that, where it represents your park, mm-hmm. but you have to, you have to use your workers to remove trees from your territory so that you have room to put like your different tetronomos. I guess the thing that's interesting, it's a minor thing, but the thing that's interesting about like the tetronomos is like usually you're always trying to build as compact as you can in these kind of games.
Yeah.
This one, nothing can touch, you can only touch corners to other tetronomos, so you always have to have spaces around everything for people to walk around. And you can expand your park similar to like Baron Park, but and you're putting your workers down. You're deciding which one of these rides you want to put down, and they all have their own unique shape. And then there's three tracks. One is there's called the emotion tracks. They're joy, awe, and thrill, I think is what they're called.
Okay.
And like at the end of each round, depending on how far you are on one of these tracks, you get different bonuses. So like. If you're really high on the first track, then you might get an extra meeple that nobody else gets, or you might get a player token, or you might get some extra money. You're also advertising your rides to try to attract more visitors. So yeah, it's cool. It's Vincent Dutre is doing all the artwork on it.
Right,
nice.
He's been just kind of, the game has been done for a while, and Vincent's just been kind of churning on it. Obviously, the pandemic has not helped progress there, and this one I'm going to go straight to retail.
Okay.
I'm real sensitive. Like, well, I know other people are sensitive too, but like, I can't have a million Kickstarter projects outstanding, right?
There's right.
People yeah. have gotten into trouble with that. It's a little shady. So, like, obviously, I want people to have faith in what I'm doing and trust me. So, I think by spring, I might have up to three outstanding Kickstarters. So there'll be Role Player Adventures. There'll be Cartographers, Heroes, and then I'm going to do a lockup expansion in the summer or in the winter. So Whoa. Until what?
wait, is this the first place you've announced this?
I think I've mentioned it every once in a while, but
that's
I don't have artwork I haven't shown any artwork for it yet, but it's the artwork is underway. Anyway,
cool.
Theme parks is because I already have three outstanding Kickstarters and I want to do more games than just three games a year.
Yeah.
Just because that's kind of how they're lining up.
Like, right.
This year I have one game coming out, which is Fiends of Familiars, the expansion for Roleplayer, but I don't have anything else coming out. Whereas in like 2022-21, I think I'll have close to five games coming out. Oof. Ooh, so it's wow. just kind of the yeah. way it worked out, and I don't want to like just let it sit in a warehouse until like it makes sense to space them out. But maybe it's just poor planning, but it's just kind of the way it worked out. So theme parks, Vincent Dutre is rocking it. It's gonna look amazing. There's a lot of these kind of theme park games that are popping up. I know like Alley Cat announced one recently.
Yeah, and Meeple Mountain. Yeah, I know it's coming pretty soon. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, in this, when I signed it, it was like, "Hey, this is a space that nobody else is in. This is really exciting." And now it's like, there's a bunch of people in the space that I didn't know was going there. And then it's like, well, how do you differentiate yourself? Like,
yeah.
it's right. just like, you've got all these theme park games, but this, but the Thunderworks one is the best. That's kind of like,
right.
it's the one that looks the best and it's the most fun. It's, I would say, it's a light. I would say it's a medium light game. It's not heavy, but there's still a lot of worker placement stuff going on. You know, it's not, it's like a family plus game, I would say.
Okay.
I think it's cool.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we would hope, right? Yeah. But, no, that's awesome. I, personally, I love the theme park theme
yeah.
In a game, and I still, like, I mean, I've seen, one, there's Steam Park, that's the yeah. first one that comes to mind, and then there was, like, kind of like a little carnival card game that came out from Upper right. Deck, I think, like, and... But it's not thematic in any way. No, and almost any theme park themed game I send my way because, yeah, I think that's one of the best themes. That you
so
can have
I think
for a
game. This is actually a game that I can probably get my wife to play because she's a huge fan of the video game series Roller Coaster Tycoon.
Right.
So I think she'd be a big fan of this just because
my park. Wife loves that game too. It's crazy.
Right. Was that part of a factor of deciding to publish this?
No, I don't think my wife has even played the prototype. No, I like those games too, you know.
That's awesome.
So yeah, we'll see. It's kind of like this in the last year there was a bunch of B games that people were doing,
mm-hmm.
and I feel like the next wave is like a bunch of theme park games, and like I'm part of that wave. But yeah. the goal is just like make sure it's the best one and the best looking one. So
yeah, you definitely picked the right artist for that.
Yeah.
I mean, We do a thing every week called the top 8 debate where we take like that top 8 ranked of like whatever category, mechanism, publisher, whatever. And
sure.
and our, this last Friday was Vincent Dutre art in games, and we debated each of those which was the best out of them. Yeah.
What was the winner?
Jaipur.
Jaipur. The Space Cowboy version of Jaipur. Yeah, see, I agree with you on that.
We can
go off topic for a little bit. What would you have voted for? That's fine.
I'm trying to think of, what is the one, Treasure Island, I think, is my favorite one.
Yeah.
Oh, so there's a role that we have that we both have had to at least play the game
and
for
only
us
I
to,
have.
And he's only played Treasure Island.
Yeah, but Treasure Island.
I've never played it either, but like, the artwork is amazing.
Yeah.
And I like the Celestia game that he did. I think, what's the name of that game?
Yeah,
there was one that is like much more abstract cover.
So no, he didn't do Selenia, I don't think.
I think he did.
Yeah, I think
was
it was Selenia was his. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he's
that new the cover that he did for that canopy game that's on Kickstarter right now.
Oh,
amazing.
That's right. Yeah, that's phenomenal. No, you pick. You're going like top of the line as far as artists go right here. You have Menzel. You have
yeah.
Dutre. You know, are there any other artists you're aiming for?
If you're gonna spend an hour, 2 hours in front of a piece of cardboard, it better look amazing.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah.
You know. And so yeah, the Dual Powers was done by Quan Chai. You know,
oh,
he's
wow.
considered one of the better artwork
yeah.
artists out there too. I mean, Quan Chai, like I love his stuff that he did for Overlight for sure.
Right. And of course, that's not to put down the artists for Roleplay because that I actually do consider them upper echelon as far as art goes. Like I really like
yeah,
the art that they do.
There's two main artists for Roleplay. The cover of the base game is done by JJ Ariosa. He did like a bunch of stuff for Summoner Wars back in the day, and he
oh,
did
yeah.
like Mice and Mystics for Plaid Hat. And he's done a bunch of stuff. And then the second artist is a guy named Lucas Ribeiro, he's Brazilian, and he did all of Lockup, and he did all of Cartographers, and he did about half of Monsters and Minions, and he did about I don't know, probably 3/4 of Fiends and Familiars, including the green cover, not the one that you have, but he did the one with the girl.
No, I had to get the big box. I have everything, so I needed the big box.
He did the cover. He did the cover of the small box one.
Okay.
He did the cover of that one too.
So we've already touched upon Cape May, correct?
Yeah, we touched briefly on it, but we just want to talk about it real quick. You said that Cape May was a follow up to, or it's your next historical game.
Right. So it's. It is a... What kind of game is Cape May? Cape May takes place in Cape May, New Jersey, in the, around the 1900s. You're basically helping develop this town. So that means it's got a little Concordia in it, in terms of, like, you've got a hand of cards, and you play them to move, but you can't get them back unless you take an action to pull them back kind of thing. But you're, like, you're buying properties, and you're building them up, and you're doing lots of Euro-y scoring stuff. You're also, so that area is also well known for bird watching. So bird watching is a part of the game as well.
That's cool.
Which, in which you're pulling birds, bird tokens out of a bag, and you're trying to collect sets for points. And there's this kind of interesting dynamic of, like, if you're building, you're developing things near the coast, then it's much more expensive. If you're developing inland, it's not. And you can develop commercial buildings and residential buildings. Then they both can be upgraded. Residential buildings can be upgraded to Victorians, and then they can become landmark Victorians, which makes like they go even higher. And basically, you kind of, there's this interesting moment where, like, at least when I play, I always kind of go commercial early so that I can, like, get my income and my engine rolling, and then it's like switching over to residential and just, like, building like crazy for victory points at the end. But there's a lot going on in the game, and it's cool. It's definitely a Euro game. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I put Michael Menzel on it. It's like, I see his artwork, and everybody knows that's a Euro game, you know?
Right. He designed Legends of Andor, if I'm not mistaken, which is totally not a Euro game, but it kind of is. But
I never played it, and I started working with him. And I was like, I should play his game, so I got it, and I've been. It's on my table. It still hasn't been played yet, but I need to play it. But obviously, like, Stone Age is one of my favorite games, and, like, he did, like Pillars of the Earth, and, like, I just played Firenze. He did Firenze. Like, I just played that yesterday, Yeah, his style is very much reads to gamers as, like, this is a Euro game.
Right. He's almost up there with, like, Clemens Franz and, like, like all of the covers you expect. He's like, oh, yeah, that's a Euro. You're trading. Good. Yeah.
All right, so the big boy that's going on right now.
Yeah, let's get to that.
Role Player Adventures.
Role Player Adventures. It's huge. Like, literally, the box is almost as big as the Gloomhaven box. It's crazy.
Oh my god.
Wow.
Somebody was, like, messaged or put a post up on BGG, like, asking about, like, how big is this box? Is it as big as the Fiends of Familiars big box? I was like, whoa, it is way bigger than that. So, it's a big box. It's got, it's a narrative adventure game. So everyone is, this kind of, like, DM-less narrative adventure game. The big kind of, the easy hook is, like, you play as one of these pre-generated characters, or you can import your character from Role Player into Role Player Adventures and play as that character. It goes over, like, there's an 11 adventure kind of story arc campaign that has, like, 10 chapters plus a big finale, and then there's a 12th adventure included that's, like, a side quest that you can kind of play whenever you want, and you can play it over and over and over and over again. So the campaign is completely replayable. There's no destructive elements. That's a question people give all the time. Mm-hmm. And then it's all about, it's like 60% reading, making choices as a group. It's a cooperative game, 1 to 4 players. And then it's like 40% rolling dice, manipulating them, like solving little dice puzzles. And the big tenet is basically, like, we want the players to be making lots of choices about the world, and we want the world to be reacting to all those choices as much as possible.
Oh, wow.
Because there's a lot of, especially in the video game world, a lot of games that promise that like just fall on their face, in my opinion. Like,
yeah.
So whether it be like a choice that then just collapses back down, and it's like, why did you even give me a choice? This is just a false choice. But like there's multiple systems built in to like allow you to, that allows the game to remember what you've done, and then we'll branch and tell you different things based on what you've accomplished. So there's like a keyword system, which is kind of really common for game books in general, where you just write down certain words, and then within the adventure, it just remembers what you've done. And then there's like a title system, so you accomplish certain things, that we give you a card, this is a title card, and it basically, that system is to remember what you've done between adventures. So like if you encounter a character in adventure 1, you might encounter them in adventure 7, and they're going to react differently based on the title that you have. And then there's a faction system. So there's three different factions in the game, and depending on what choices you make, your factions are going to go up or down. There's the Kingsguard, there's the Dragul, which is kind of like the good guys and the bad guys, and then there's like the cult in the middle, which is called the Starlit Door. And they all have different motivations. They're all trying to control this big gate at the end that's been prophesized to open. And they all have different reasons for that, and they're all trying to go about that in different ways. And all your choices are leading towards, we'll push your faction around, and depending on what your faction is at any given point, you're going to have different story experiences mm-hmm. as a result. So, yeah, it's cool. Each adventure takes roughly, the first one's the shortest because it's more of a tutorial than anything else. But most of the adventures are about 2 hours long. I just did a word count. Yesterday or something, there's like over 420,000 words in this game. So it's like, it's insane. There's also comes with there's an expansion that you can get called Nephros's Judgment, which lets you import both your backstory and your alignment into the game. And then it gives each backstory from Roleplayer, which is, there's 41 of them. Every single one of them has a unique side quest that has like four different parts.
Okay.
The choices that you make in the side quest will push your alignment around. And then at the very end, this goddess will basically passes judgment on you based on your choices. And she gives you some cool cards for your deck. And so that's the thing. I've been, me and James and a handful of other writers, I think we had like six writers working at one point. I've been working on this thing for a long time. And I'm super excited about it. And I think everybody should go check it out.
Right.
I'm super excited about it as well. I am a backer. I'm like the all in with the expansion and everything with it. So I'm excited for it. I can't wait to get it.
Yeah, and
yeah, man. It's crazy. Go ahead.
I'm noticing that I'm looking over a preview picture of like most of the components, and it looks like there's a pile of books in the middle. Is each scenario a book, or what is
right.
what am
so
I
each,
looking at?
Each adventure has its own book, and each adventure has its own map. That's basically how it works. So there's six double-sided, there's like six maps, and they're all double-sided, so that means there's 12 adventures. And then, if you were looking at the same image, there's a shortened book that is a skill check book, where you'd like do all your skill checks out of. And then, everybody's got their character board that they're managing their resources. They've got stamina that they're spending to get dice out of a bag to meet certain requirements. The combat has a little bit of, if you played One Deck Dungeon, it has some elements
okay.
there. But it's got, all kinds of cool stuff. There's like a party journal that you're tracking where everything is in between adventures for like the different factions and how much gold you have and how much XP you have and what title cards you have. And then it's also where you write down your keywords and what chapter you're on and how many times you've died and that kind of stuff. So, because when you die, every time you die, you get like a unique entry because there's like a storyline going on underneath the story. That's in the death plane that if you die a bunch of times you get to get exposed to.
That's neat.
It's also like heavily influenced by point and click adventure games. So like if you play like Police Quest or King's Quest or Maniac Mansion or those kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a big mechanical piece of this game where you get party items like I think in the picture, I'm assuming you're looking at the same thing. On the right side, there's a blue ball there on that card. That's the Bluestone Fireball. So you can get that party item. And then you can try to use that at any location on the map. Now, most maps have like about six locations. And then it's kind of like you get to try to use this item if you want. And then you can read the text specifically for that item in that location. Or you can use any combination of two items in each location and read like a special entry just for that. So if you go exploring and using items in different places, there's like this additional level of narrative where we're adding a bunch of humor, like funny things that are happening. Or like, because you're using these two objects together, it doesn't make any sense, so we're gonna kind of throw some funny stuff at you. Or it's giving you like lore elements, so like adding depth to the world. And so like, if you don't really care about that stuff and you just want like, I have my prize and I wanna go, then you can kind of do that. But there's kind of multiple like story levels to the game. And then adding the backstory onto there as well as like another element. So narrative first, adventuring, right. Use your character. It's cool.
Yeah, no, I'm excited for it. I can't wait to play it. I'm like, my only issue with this is I got to wait till next year to play it.
I know. These things take forever, man. I'm telling you.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the problems. So I use Panda Manufacturing for all my games, and they do really, really great stuff. Yeah. But also their timelines are a little bit longer than most people.
Right.
So the game is pretty dang close to done. It's just we're kind of in polish town as much as we can. And then as soon as the Kickstarter is over, within the next month or so, like files go to the printer and we go off. It's not like some of these Kickstarter creators, they're like, you know, the Kickstarter will be over and then they'll spend the next like 6 months working on the game. It's like, dude, shouldn't you have had this like ready to go before you put this on Kickstarter?
Yeah,
right.
So I like to have my games at like 90% ready to go before I start asking for anybody for money. So
yeah, no, I'm like I said, I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to play it. I can wait. Just I get impatient at times.
We'll just play role player in the time.
Yeah, well, I still got to get Fiends of Familiar to the table. So
there you go. If you aren't, like, this is available, the first adventure is available for play on Tabletopia and Tabletop Simulator.
Oh,
obviously, it's not as cool as the real thing, but they are there if you want to check them out there.
Yeah, no, that's awesome that you're doing that. And I saw on your website as well, you're also doing, like, you did, like, a Bullfrogs print and play. And, like, it's awesome that you're supporting the community, even though it's, you know, we're all stuck.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, I gave away people are welcome to download Bullfrog's print play on my website for sure. It's just, you know, it's a cool game, and not that many people played it because it wasn't. I know Renegade reprinted it, and I printed it, but still, I mean, it's an older game, and people are very much focused on whatever came out in the last year or two. So like, there's a lot of people that have entered this hobby well after the release of that game, so they probably have never even heard of it. So
yeah. Well, we'd like to thank you for your time again for joining us today and this blast from the past for you.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
Well, what did you take from it, Keith? Hopefully you had a good time with us.
Yeah, today. Man, this is great. I mean, the thing is, like, it's hard to get me to stop talking sometimes. Like, I just get excited about stuff and I just keep talking. So, yeah, I had fun. It's a good time. Obviously, I've got plans for... I still feel like I'm getting off the ground in terms of, like... you know, I'm still figuring. I've been doing this full time for 2 years, so it's like I'm still figuring out like how many games do I want to be doing a year, and like, like how do I grow my company, and like who can I kind of get in here to help me be a little bit more efficient, and how many of the games do I publish? Do I want them to be from me, and how many am I okay from other designers? So like, there's lots of that, and kind of stepping through this process has kind of been fun. And I just feel like I'm still poised and ready to attack. Like I don't even feel like I'm off the ground yet, you know. So
We know good things are gonna come. You can just tell from all the publishers and designers that we've talked to. They all kind of share the same passion for what they do, and the fact that it's like they all still like. Kurt was a perfect example of that. The owner of Smirk and Dagger. He's been doing this for like 17, 18 years, and he still has that I'm ready to go. Let's do this. And, and you share that with them. So that's good to see. We really do appreciate you taking the time to hang out with us today. Do we want to give a quick sound out before we talk about what's happening next week?
Sure. Just make sure if you want to, you can go to Kickstarter and back Role Player Adventures if you're interested. When we upload this to YouTube and as well as the Podbean, I will leave a link down. This will go up on Monday. So there will still be time. There will be a link in the description.
Yep. So if you haven't done so yet, go back. Go back. Like, don't even worry about what it is. Just go back it. Role Player Adventures. Like, this is telling you from a Euro guy. Just go back it. It makes sense. It looks good. It looks phenomenal. Cool. So we're excited for that. We're going to give a quick send out, and then hang out with us for now. This upcoming week, we have Wednesday talking about the best and worst inserts in games. And that'll be... Feel free to voice your opinion if you have any suggestions. And then this upcoming Friday...
Friday's top 8 debate of games ranked under 1,000 on BGG. The top 8 games ranked under 1,000.
Yeah, so that's going to be a weird debate that we're something that we've never debated before.
Yeah.
And then, so as always with our Twitch users, we thank you for joining in. We broadcast this live every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at around noon,
Mountain Daylight
Savings Time, on twitch.tv/everydayboardgames.
You can also find the re-uploads on our YouTube channel, Everyday Board Games 2020, usually about a week or two in advance, as well as the audio versions on Podbean at Everyday Board Games Podcast.
And you can get a hold of Keith and check out his Kickstarter coming up soon. Kickstarter.com, search for...
Not soon, it's on.
Oh, it's on right now, I'm sorry. It's
Role Player Adventures will help you find that.
Yep, Role Player Adventures, and also Thunderworks.com. Or is it ThunderworksGames? ThunderworksGames, and I have that as well. I'll bring that up on the page here. ThunderworksGames.com. And so, yeah, we want to thank you so much for tuning in, and you have a wonderful day. Thanks, Keith.
Have a good one.
Thanks, guys.